Hallelujah. Psalm 6. The psalmist in this psalm, as you'll see in a moment, is really very sick, ill, grievously ill. Death is threatening. And his physical pain, as we'll see, is accompanied by inner anguish, psychological pain, and the fear of death. Now, it's all very understandable, isn't it? And he's feeling very vulnerable before his enemies. They're taking advantage of his weakness. Seeing his suffering as God's punishment for his sin, there's another mental thing. Of course, that was their mentality. If I'm suffering and if God's controlling the world, then God must be causing the suffering. Well, God is just, so God wouldn't cause me to suffer unjustly. You got the logic? So I must have done something wrong. Or if I didn't do something wrong, my father did something wrong, and I'm copying it because we're all kind of we're all together in this. So they had this mentality that negative experiences are always an indication of sin. You remember the gospel still there. The man was born blind, and they said to Jesus, is this his sin or the sin of his parents that he's born blind? It's just a mental thing. And it isn't just in the Old Testament or the scriptures of the New Testament, not in the writings, but in the people. It's still alive and well today. And it's almost automatic if something goes wrong. And since we have done so many things wrong, it's not difficult to make a link and think, oh, well, because he assumes, this man, as you'll see, that he's in this situation because he's sinned. So he turns to God and asks God to forgive his sin. And if God forgives his sin, then he'll get well again. None of that is logical. None of it's actually true. You have to go deeper to get any truth in all that. And there's a deep truth in it. But he doesn't want to die. And that's what this psalm is about. So let's look at verse 1. Yahweh, rebuke me, but not in your anger. Now, I've translated that so carefully. You won't find that if you look at your Bible. They say, do not rebuke me in your anger. But that doesn't get it. He's not actually saying that. He's saying, Yahweh, rebuke me. In other words, I need to be rebuked, but not in your anger, like cool it. You know, that'd be too tough. Discipline me, but not in your wrath. And we did that last week, the anger of God, the wrath of God, which is a projection, of course, onto God from our situation, in the mentality that thinks God run the world. Be gracious to me, we've done that already, Yahweh, for I'm languishing. Heal me, Yahweh, for my bones are shaking with terror. Pretty graphic and good, isn't it? My whole being is racked with pain, while you, Yahweh, how long? How long do I have to wait for you to forgive me and heal me and give me life again? And, you know, it's been going on for months and I'm tired of it. You get the feel of it. Now, I won't ever do this again, but I'm going to read the Hebrew of those three verses, and I want you just to listen. You won't understand it particularly. I've translated it. But I want you to hear, and you'll hear little rhymes and assonances, and you'll hear the poetry of it, I hope. Yahweh, albe apeka tokiheni, v'al bahamateka to yasareni. Honeni Yahweh, ki umlal ani. Rupa eni Yahweh, ki nibalu samai. V'nafshi nibala meod, v'ata Yahweh admatai. That's it. It's got a sound about it. How do you get that in English? You can't translate poetry. But with that, with a harp behind it, and if you were really feeling stricken and death was right there and you're in pain, at least you'd feel, well, you're not the first one, so you've got a bit of company in this. Verse 4. Turn, Yahweh, hold back my being from death. in your kindness, save me. For in the realm of death, no one calls on you. In Sheol, that's Hades, the underworld, who can give you praise?
Is that kindness being visited?
Yes, it always will be. So we need to pause and we need to look at this mentality here. In the realm of death, no one calls on you. In Sheol, who can give you praise? I'm going to take you through five little points firstly here. I'm trying to help you understand the attitude of the afterlife resurrection that's typical of the biblical literature. So the first thing to say is, the basic understanding is, as it was in the Greek world and the Roman world, the world, apart from that extraordinary exception called Egypt, which has got to be looked at differently, you know, the mummifying and all that stuff, that's pretty special. But in normal parts, everywhere else as far as I know, anyhow, there was the sense that you'd go down to Hades and that's it. In Hades, you're kind of there, but it's a wispy, shadowy existence down, and because they ghosts kind of came, and you didn't stop existing, but you stopped living, and life was over. Well, I'll give you some texts. Psalm 88, verse 3 to 5 reads, "My soul is full of troubles, my life draws near to Sheol. I'm counted among those who go down to the pit, grave. I'm like those who have no help, like the forsaken among the dead, like the slain that lie in the grave, like those whom you remember no more, for they're cut off from your hand." They're dead. That's the end, really. Psalm 115, verse 17. "The dead do not praise Yahweh, nor do any that go down into silence." So I want to stay alive where I can praise you. It's kind of bargaining. You get all my praise if I'm alive. If I'm dead, I'm no good to you. So keep me alive, you know. Isaiah chapter 38, verse 18. "Sheol cannot thank you. Death cannot praise you. Those who go down to the pit cannot hope for your faithfulness. The living, they thank you as I do this day. Fathers, make known to their children your faithfulness." And finally, the book of Sirach, written, you know, 180 years before Jesus, modern, in other words, late Judaism, reads, chapter 17, verse 27 of the book of Sirach, "Who will sing praises to the Most High in Hades?" See, it's written in Greek. Or actually, we've got the Greek translation anyhow. "In place of the living, who gives thanks?" Nobody. "From the dead, as from one who doesn't exist, thanksgiving has ceased. Those who are alive and well sing Yahweh's praises." So you got that, okay? That's the general mentality. However, at the same time in the Bible, you'll see a longing for an enduring relationship with God that transcends death. Even though that's, they presumed it didn't, but they still longed for it, as we can well imagine. Let me read for you Psalm 16, verse 9. "My heart is glad, my soul rejoices, my body also rests secure. For you do not give me up to Sheol. You do not let your faithful one, Hasid, see the pit, grave. You show me the path of life. In your presence there is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore." You see, he's kind of hoping he'll live forever. It's a bit unreal, but he's okay. Psalm 19, verse 15. "God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol. God will receive me." Now, the author of that isn't meaning God will rescue me by raising me from the dead. He means he'll rescue me by pulling me back from death. See? Don't read it wrongly. But there's something longing happening there. Lastly, Psalm 73, verse 23. "I am continually with you. You hold my right hand. you guide me with your counsel, and afterward you will receive me with honour. Whom have I in heaven but you? There's nothing on earth that I desire other than you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Okay. A third point that I'd like to just add here is they did have these strange stories, two of them, Enoch and Elijah, which indicate obviously death's mysterious, and obviously after death is mysterious, so you don't expect a clear view. But Enoch, you remember, it's in the book of Genesis. Here it is. It's only one text, Genesis chapter 5, verse 2, which says, Enoch walked with God, and then he was no more because God took him. God took him. Enoch didn't die, Genesis 5, 2. Hebrews 11, 5 in the New Testament, speaking about Enoch, says, he did not experience death. So they've got this strange figure, mysterious legendary figure from the past who's somehow still alive with God. Didn't die, because if he died, he's dead. So it's not as if he rose, he's just not dead. And you know the story of Elijah, surely? Taken up in a whirlwind, alive. So one day, they all started to think, this Elijah's going to come back to earth, and then we'll know the Messiah is due. And it even comes into the New Testament. They asked Jesus, and he said, look, it was about John the Baptist. He's your Elijah. He didn't buy into the folklore, but he kind of, the realization of that hope is in John the Baptist. In other words, I'm the Messiah, kind of thing. So you've got those, and those characters there. And here's the Book of Wisdom, the Old Testament book, the latest of the books, chapter 4, verse 10, has this statement. There were some who pleased God and were loved by God, and while living among sinners, were taken up. They were caught up so that evil might not change their understanding or guile deceive their souls. Some, he's obviously talking about Enoch and Elijah, I don't know who else he's talking about, but in the legendary folklore there were other figures, presumably. So here we are trying to give you a bit of a feel for the Old Testament understanding. Fourth point. There is this idea of the possibility of afterlife in some of the ancient texts too. Not too ancient, but some of the Jewish texts. I'll give you, this is Isaiah chapter 26, and I'm going to read to you from verse 14 and 19, and it reads like this. The dead do not live, shades do not rise, shades, you know, shadowy, because you've punished and destroyed them and wiped out all memory of them. And a few texts later, your dead shall live, their corpses shall rise. O dwellers in the dust, awake, sing for joy, for your dew is a radiant dew, and the earth will give birth to those long dead. Obviously, emerging is this feeling for that. How late that text is very hard to say. But now, the final point I want to make is the idea, firm idea, of resurrection from the dead, meaning bodily resurrection, which really means human resurrection, not just wafting spirits, but the person, don't think body like this, but that the person would somehow mysteriously rise from the dead, that actually came at the time of the Maccabees. And the reason is pretty clear historically. They always presumed, as I've said, death was what it was, and it was a punishment, and if you died young, that was always a punishment from God and a tragedy. And if you lived an old age, well, you lived on in your kids, and that was fair enough, and they obviously faced the fact that we die, and dreadful as it is, but they saw particularly death of the young and all that as a punishment, and death in war was a punishment because God was on the other side because we'd sinned. All this logic is hopeless, but that's what they were living in. But then at the time of the Maccabees, you had these wonderful people being martyred by the Syrians, you know, in Jerusalem, the mother of the Maccabees, you probably know the story, and the seven boys. And it kind of, sometimes things happen in a community that everyone starts to think a certain way again. Like something happens that stops you. It just opens your mind. There's a critical mass or something, and at last you start to look at things. We start to get the message. It's so damn slow, but anyhow, it can happen. And at the time of the Maccabees, the thought the emerges that these kids couldn't be being punished by God. They're saints. They're these young people that are dying for their faith. They're heroes. God couldn't be punishing them, you see. So if God is good and God is loving, there must be more to life than what we know. There must be another way of God drawing them into the fullness of life. So the idea of the resurrection emerges. You find it in the book of Daniel. I'll read it to you. Daniel chapter 12, the first verse reads, "At that time your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt." So you get the beginnings of that thought of heaven and hell and punishment. That was Daniel chapter 12, verse 1. And you find it also in the second book of Maccabees, contemporary with that text, chapter 7, verse 36. And it reads, "Our brothers, after enduring a brief suffering, have drunk of ever-flowing life under God's covenant. But you, by the judgment of God, will receive just punishment for your arrogance." And he's talking about the persecutors. But our brothers, those who have died after enduring a brief suffering, have drunk of ever-flowing life under God's covenant. At the time of Jesus, and I'll conclude with this because I can't go into the whole subject anymore. At the time of Jesus, as you probably know, there was confusion among the people. The Pharisees, the descendants of the Hasidim at the time of the Maccabean revolt, that's the thing, those who stood by the law and were faithful to Judaism, they were convinced that there was a resurrection from the dead. The Sadducees, the ancient, the priestly caste and the leaders of the people and those who were traditionalists and weren't into the modern newfangled ideas, they all said, "Well, rubbish. It's not in the Bible. It's not true. It's just a fancy idea." They were against it. And you might recall Paul once when he was dragged in front of the community and they were about to pull into bits. He said, "I'm here because I'm a Pharisee and I believe in the resurrection of the dead." And then all the Pharisees said, yeah. And then the Pharisees started to fight the Sadducees and Paul ducked down. Got, you know, divide and conquer. They all fought among themselves. So there was confusion. In the Christian community, there was no confusion because of what Jesus said. He said, "You don't know what you're talking about." They had all this silly stuff, the Sadducees, you know, about a woman who married this man and this one. And he said, "You don't know what you're reading. You don't understand the scriptures and you don't understand the power of God. God is the God of the living, not the dead." And so he believed in, and the Christian church talks about, the resurrection. So come back to where we are, which is where?
I'm exhausted with my groaning.
Oh, thank you. Good. Thank you, Alan. Verse 6. "I'm exhausted with my groaning. All night long I drench my pillow with tears. I soak my couch with weeping. My eyes waste away with grief. Life is ebbing away. Everything is against me. Depart from me, all you who do evil. Yahweh has heard my weeping. Yahweh has heard my supplication. Yahweh has welcomed my prayer. They fall back, all my enemies, struck with terror. They're foiled and confounded." So he's convinced that God has heard his prayer. Maybe he's recovered. Maybe, you know, the fever is gone. I don't know what the situation is, but, you know, there's that. And by the way, that first verse in chapter 8, "Depart from me, all you who do evil," is actually quoted in Matthew's Gospel on the lips of Jesus. So You recall when Jesus said, this is in the Sermon on the Mount, it's not those who say, Lord, Lord, who enter the kingdom of heaven, it's those who do the will of my Father. Then he goes on a few more later and says, I will declare to them, that's those who have all the right words but aren't doing God's will, I will declare to them, says Jesus, I never knew you, depart from me, all you who do evil. So Jesus himself is quoting the psalm. Not saying Jesus is going to push them out, we know that. But he's saying, there's no place. You've said no and I can't do anything about it. So you can't pretend, it matters what we do. And if you're living in darkness, you're living in darkness. So Jesus says with tears in his eyes, in other words, this is your choice. I wish it was otherwise. And for all eternity, he would love us to be different. But Jesus isn't mucking around. He's not saying love automatically succeeds, because we've got to choose. And the way of life we live matters. And if we block it off forever, God, for all eternity, will love me, but I'll be in hell because I've obstinately refused to welcome the love.